Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a really substantial piece of work. This recently released report from the Select Subcommittee, they really dug into all sorts of angles of the COVID-19 pandemic response.
It's quite a document.
It really is. We're not just skimming the surface here. We've gone through this massive report, you know, packed with findings from investigations, hearings. We tried to pull out what we think are the most crucial insights.
Yeah, the goal is really to make it understandable.
Exactly. Give you a clear overview of some absolutely key areas. Mm-hmm. Now, for those of you listening in Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena, grasping the bigger picture of how these pandemic responses played out nationally, well, it's so important.
It really is.
They can genuinely help us think about how our own communities can, you know, better prepare for and make informed decisions when facing future public health challenges.
Absolutely. This report gives a very detailed look into the decision-making processes, the consequences of actions taken right at the federal level.
Right.
So for our listeners right here in the Southeast Houston region, understanding these dynamics, it offers valuable context as we consider our local preparedness, our resilience. It's about taking those bigger lessons and seeing how they might apply, you know, closer to home.
Okay, let's get right into it then. First up, vaccine boosters. The report makes a pretty strong assertion here.
Mm-hmm.
It says the Biden administration's announcement of COVID-19 vaccine boosters for all American adults. Well, it happened somewhat arbitrarily, maybe without the clear scientific backing of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP.
Right, the ACIP.
For people who might not know, what exactly is ACIP? Why is their scientific backing such a big deal in these decisions?
So ACIP is this independent group. It's made up of medical and public health experts, and they give recommendations to the CDC on how vaccines should be used.
Okay.
Their scientific evaluations are really like the gold standard for informing vaccine policy.
Hmm.
So when their advice isn't followed, well, it raises some important questions.
Yeah, you'd think their voice would carry a lot of weight.
Exactly. And the report highlights that CDC Director Rochelle Walensky, she ultimately went against the expert advice from ACIP. The suggestion in the report is that maybe this decision was more aligned with the president's public vaccination goals rather than purely based on the scientific data that this committee assessed.
Mm.
And this brings up a fundamental question, doesn't it, about the balance between, say, political imperatives and scientific guidance during a crisis. It's a tension that, well, likely contributed to some public confusion and maybe even distrust.
And there were specific experts involved too, right? The report names ACIP, of course, but also Dr. Marion Gruber and Dr. Philip Kraus. They were former directors at the FDA's Office of Vaccines Research and Review.
Yes, precisely. Their expertise would have been absolutely central to these kinds of decisions.
So what happened there?
Well, what's particularly striking is that the report also notes their departure. Dr. Gruber and Dr. Kraus left the FDA shortly after this period.
Oh, interesting timing.
It suggests a potential link, perhaps, to their disagreements about the necessity, the timing of booster shots for the general population.
Mm.
You know, when expert scientific advice seems to be set aside for reasons that might not be purely scientific, it can certainly erode that perception of integrity in public health decisions.
Yeah, I can see that.
And that has real consequences for how people view and respond to future guidance, even right down at the local level.
Moving on a bit, the report also looks into the doctor-patient relationship, specifically around using off-label prescriptions. It suggests that using these during the pandemic was maybe unfairly criticized, and this could have damaged that really important trust between doctors and their patients.
This is a significant point, yeah. It's about the wider fallout, the ripple effects from the pandemic response. The report argues that the intense focus and sometimes, frankly, negative messaging around certain treatments, including these off-label uses.
Huh.
Well, it could have made it harder for doctors to have those really open, honest conversations with their patients about all the options that might have been available. It really makes you think, doesn't it, about the balance between broad public health messaging and those individual medical decisions that doctors and patients have to make together. You know, how do you ensure that people, say, in Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena, feel empowered to have those crucial conversations with their own doctors?
Now, let's talk about something that really hit home for families right here, school closures. The report states pretty unequivocally that these long-term closures we saw, they weren't actually supported by the science and evidence available at the time.
That's a really significant conclusion, yes. And the report goes further. It highlights the influence of the American Federation of Teachers, the AFT.
Right.
And it emphasizes, you know, the AFT isn't a scientific or medical organization.
So, okay, they mentioned the AFT's involvement, but what's the key takeaway there, especially thinking about future decisions impacting kids and education right here in our communities?
Well, it raises questions, doesn't it, about the appropriate role of non-scientific bodies in shaping public health policies, especially ones with such huge impacts.
The report even mentions specific people here, Randy Weingarten, president of the AFT, and Dr. Tracy Hoag, who did research on school transmission. It sounds like there were really different ways of looking at the data on school safety.
Exactly. The report details how the CDC's guidance on reopening schools, on mask wearing, how it changed over time.
Mm-hmm.
What's particularly revealing, according to the report, is the information about the AFT suggesting specific triggers for school closures. Apparently, while the AFT pushed for these, the CDC ultimately didn't recommend them.
Why not?
They cited a lack of scientific evidence to back up those particular thresholds. The report even points to emails between AFT reps and the CDC, suggesting the AFT had, well, some input into the CDC's operational strategies for schools. This level of engagement from a non-governmental body, it really underscores the complexities, doesn't it? Creating and communicating public health guidance during a crisis where different groups might have different priorities. And it also makes you wonder about the long-term consequences of those closures, something we're probably still seeing the effects of, you know, in child development, mental well-being, right here in our own neighborhoods.
This brings us to the origins of COVID-19, always a huge topic of discussion. The report touches on the early theories, including the lab leak hypothesis, and then it focuses on that paper, the proximal origin paper, and its authors, Dr. Rambaugh, Dr. Anderson, Dr. Lipkin, Holmes, and Gary.
Yes, that paper was very significant in the early scientific discussions. And the report's findings about the timeline of his publication are quite interesting, especially the involvement of Dr. Fauci and Dr. Collins in its initial stages.
What did it say about their involvement?
The report highlights Dr. Anderson's testimony. He apparently stated the paper was, quote, prompted by Dr. Fauci, Jeremy Farrar, and Francis Collins, and that the goal was, again quoting, to disprove the lab leak theory.
That's a pretty direct statement about the intent.
It is. And the report also mentions Dr. Lipkin's initial concerns, especially about the furin cleavage site in the virus.
Right. I remember hearing about that.
Apparently, he expressed worries early on, even suggesting privately he thought the virus might have originated in a lab. This detail really shows the scientific uncertainties, how opinions were maybe shifting during those critical early weeks.
For those of us who aren't virologists, can you briefly explain why things like the furin cleavage site and the receptor binding domain were such key points in this early debate?
Certainly. Think of the furin cleavage site as like a molecular key. It helps the virus get into human cells more easily. Its presence in SARS-CoV-2 was seen as somewhat unusual compared to similar viruses, which made some scientists wonder if it could have been, you know, engineered. And the receptor binding domain. That's like the part of the key that actually fits the lock on our cells. Its specific structure also fed into those scientific discussions about whether the virus evolved naturally or might have had some kind of lab involvement.
The report also touches on gain-of-function research. That's been controversial. Can you clarify what that is, maybe in simple terms?
Sure. Imagine scientists tweaking a virus in a lab, maybe making changes to see if it becomes more infectious or perhaps more dangerous. That's essentially what gain-of-function research involves.
And the controversy.
It often revolves around whether the potential benefits of doing that kind of research, understanding viruses better, maybe developing treatments, outweigh the risks involved, you know, the risk of creating something dangerous or it accidentally escaping.
Right.
The report mentions the NIH's position, that the research they funded under the EcoHealth Alliance grant didn't meet their specific definition of gain-of-function that would trigger certain extra safety protocols. But this interpretation itself has been a subject of ongoing debate among scientists.
And this connects to EcoHealth Alliance's Project Diffuse proposal to DARPA. What was that about?
So Project Diffuse was a research proposal EcoHealth submitted to DARPA. That's the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. The report points out this proposal included plans to engineer certain viruses and specifically mentioned inserting furin cleavage sites.
The very feature we were just talking about.
Exactly. Ultimately, DARPA decided not to fund this project, and the report indicates that concerns about biosecurity and maybe the lack of a clear plan for handling potential risks from gain-of-function research were key factors in that decision.
Let's switch gears to another really important area, how pandemic programs were overseen, and the fraud. The report estimates over $191 billion in unemployment insurance payments might have been fraudulent. That is just staggering.
It is an enormous figure, and the report emphasizes that transnational criminal organizations were actually involved in a lot of this fraud. Yeah. It really highlights how vulnerable these emergency relief efforts were, especially when the priority was speed, just getting aid out quickly. For our listeners in Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena, it makes you think how those resources could have been better used right here in our own communities if there had been stronger safeguards.
So what went wrong? The report points to specific weaknesses, right?
It does. It identifies a lack of strong checks before payments went out, failures to properly verify who was applying for aid.
Basic stuff, it sounds like.
Well, yeah, but challenging to implement quickly at scale. This contributed to a lot of improper payments in programs like the PPP, the Paycheck Protection Program, and the EIDL, the Economic Injury Disaster Loan Program.
Mm-hmm.
There were also significant issues, the report says, with how federal and state agencies shared information and coordinated that made it much harder to prevent and catch fraud.
The World Health Organization, the WHO, also comes under scrutiny in this report. What are the main points raised there?
The report touches on the U.S.'s reliance on the WHO, particularly early on, and it raises concerns about how the WHO handled the initial outbreak. Specifically, there are mentions of concerns about the WHO's relationship with China and perceived limitations, maybe biases, in the investigation into COVID-19's origins. This has broader implications, you know, for how international health organizations operate and how nations rely on them during global health crises.
Let's move to the Strategic National Stockpile, the SNS, and those supply chain problems we all remember. What did the report find there?
Well, it highlights that the SNS just wasn't equipped for the sheer scale of demand during the pandemic. Critical supplies like masks, gloves, PPE were depleted really rapidly.
Yeah, I remember trying to find masks early on.
Exactly. So a key recommendation from the report is that states should maintain their own emergency medical supply stockpiles to be more self-sufficient. Additionally, the report points out a major vulnerability, the U.S. pharmaceutical supply chain. It notes our heavy dependence on China for the active ingredients in many of our medications.
That seems risky.
It's a really critical point for national security, and even just for ensuring access to necessary medicines right here in our local pharmacies.
The report also looks at some public health measures that were put in place, and it raises questions about the scientific basis for some, like the 6-foot social distancing rule.
Yes. The report specifically mentions Dr. Fauci's testimony.
Mm-hmm.
He apparently said he wasn't aware of any specific scientific data supporting that 6-foot rule.
Really?
Yeah. It shows how some guidelines might have been based more on, say, expert judgment or general caution rather than hard scientific evidence. It makes you think about how these guidelines were communicated and the impact they had, you know, on businesses, social interactions right here in our communities.
And mask mandates were another area with a lot of back and forth, weren't they?
Oh, definitely. The report details the changes, the sometimes conflicting advice on masks from the CDC and the administration. It also mentions potential downsides of prolonged mask wearing, especially for children, possible effects on speech and language development, for instance.
Hmm.
Furthermore, the report presents the argument that the widespread COVID-19 lockdowns maybe caused more harm than good overall. It cites potential increases in mental health issues, substance abuse, delays in people getting necessary medical care.
Wow.
And finally, it touches on the controversy around vaccine passports and their potential negative impacts on public trust and, well, political divisions.
The situation in New York nursing homes early in the pandemic was just devastating. What does the report say about the policies there?
The report summarizes findings about the Cuomo administration's policies, particularly that March 25th directive. The one involving sending COVID-positive residents back to nursing homes.
I remember the outcry about that.
Yes. It also highlights the roles of Melissa DeRosa and Dr. Howard Zucker in how nursing home deaths were reported. And the controversy around initially not including deaths that happened outside the facilities in the official counts. The report points to delays and a lack of transparency in releasing the full data.
That seems critical in a crisis.
Absolutely. It really underscores the importance of transparency and accurate data, which is crucial at all levels, including our local health departments right here.
Okay, let's move on to COVID-19 testing and vaccines. The report covers a lot here, from the early testing problems to the vaccine rollout.
Right. It acknowledges those early issues with CDC test kits. but it also recognizes the vital role private companies played in quickly scaling up testing capacity and quality.
Operation Warp Speed gets mentioned, too, for the vaccines.
Yes, it highlights the remarkable speed of vaccine development under Operation Warp Speed. However, the report also suggests that the Biden administration and some public health officials perhaps overstated how well the vaccines prevented infection and transmission.
Which might have affected trust later on.
Possibly. That's the suggestion. It could have contributed to a decline in public trust. The early disagreements among scientists about needing booster shots, you know, reflected in Dr. Gruber and Dr. Krell's leaving the FDA, are also noted.
Right. We mentioned them earlier.
The report briefly touches on the discussion comparing natural immunity to vaccine-induced immunity and the impact of the Department of Defense vaccine mandate on military recruitment.
What about VA EARS, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System?
The report presents VA EARS as an important system for tracking vaccine safety. It does note the significant number of adverse event reports linked to COVID-19 vaccines compared to others.
But a report doesn't automatically mean causation, right?
Exactly. The report emphasizes that. A report in VA EARS doesn't prove the vaccine caused the event. It also discusses the U.S. government's programs for compensating people who experience vaccine injuries, mainly the Countermeasures Injury Compensation Program, CICP, and points out its limitations.
Okay.
It's careful to distinguish between individuals who've had vaccine injuries and the broader anti-vaccine movement. And it briefly mentions ensuring informed consent when vaccines are under Emergency Use Authorization, or EUA, the potential pressure on doctors to recommend vaccines and boosters, and the implications for the doctor-patient relationship are also touched upon.
And finally, the report looks at the economic impacts and the government's response.
Right, briefly. It mentions the widespread economic disruption, business closures, supply chain chaos, the varying impacts on different industries, different wage earners. It also notes the significant actions the Federal Reserve took, the monetary policy, trying to address the economic crisis. These national trends, of course, had direct consequences for businesses and families right here in Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena.
One last area the report digs into is government accountability and transparency. What were the main findings there?
Well, the report highlights instances where the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, allegedly lacked transparency. And in some cases, according to the report, obstructed the Select Subcommittee's investigation.
How so?
Things like refusing to provide details on how they searched for requested documents, delaying and then ultimately canceling an interview with a key official, Ms. Egorin. Trying to limit the testimony of Dr. David Morins through what the report suggests were questionable means. It also mentions issues getting documents from Boston University and EcoHealth.
So a lack of openness.
That lack of transparency at the federal level, the report argues, can make it harder for everyone, including local communities, to understand the full picture and really learn from what happened.
This has been a really in-depth look at a very comprehensive report. Wow. To sum up, what are the main overarching themes that really stand out to you after going through all this?
I think the key themes that emerge are, first, the complexities and, frankly, controversies around how scientific advice was used or maybe not used in making public health decisions. Second, the wide-ranging, sometimes unexpected consequences of the various public health measures that were put in place. Third, significant shortcomings in government oversight and accountability, especially with relief funds. And finally, really crucial questions about government transparency throughout the whole pandemic.
Yeah. This deep dive, as you can hear, it really only scratches the surface of this huge investigation. We've tried to focus on specific findings that we thought would be particularly interesting and relevant for you, especially as residents here in Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena. It's just so important, I think, to consider how these broader national issues might have played out right here in our own communities and what lessons we can learn to strengthen our local preparedness.
Absolutely. Understanding the challenges, the shortcomings, and the national response, it can really inform how our local health departments, our emergency management agencies, our community leaders prepare for whatever comes next. You know, considering the complexities we've discussed, it really highlights the importance of strong local planning, clear, consistent communication, and just making sure trustworthy information is readily available right here at the community level.
So, considering all the findings we've discussed today, what do you think are the most important things for ensuring effective and crucially trustworthy responses to future public health emergencies? Not just nationally, but right here in our own Southeast Houston communities. It's definitely something for all of us to give some serious thought to.